The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, January 28th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Folks, it's another one of our best ofs, 2016. We've got a great program for you today. Jane Mayer, the legendary Jane Mayer, wrote a massive piece on the Koch brothers.
And one of the best books of the year, Dark Money.
And Dark Money. And we spoke to her about Dark Money. I mean, I guess they were interrelated. Important because guys like Russ Feingold, they lost because of the Koch brothers money. Period. End of story. Nothing else need be said. And ancillary to Koch brothers money, I'm not convinced that the Mercers on some level aren't part of their network. They outspent Zephyr Teachout. These are just high profile examples of this, but this is going on around the country. And so, you know, we talked yesterday to Mark Blythe about the mood in the country, that people have been subjected to. We also spoke to Amanda Taub about authoritarians, and certainly a guy like Donald Trump triggers those authoritarians. But now we're getting into the more sort of practical ways in which this election also turned. And Jane Mayer, a really important thing for you to listen to. And then, of course, Matt will put in his special comedy snippet from from the year that was. And then, if you're a member of this program, because you're smart and witty and charming.
Indeed.
And attractive, both inside, which permeates through your flesh to outside.
Just reflected in the outside. A member, frankly, a card-carrying member of Koch Nation.
There you go. We should actually have, we're going to do those cards. If you're not, of course, you can just go to jointhemajorityreport.com. But if you're a member, you can listen to our interview with Lewis Lapham. And by our, I mean Janine Garofalo and I, back from the Deep Archives. This is back in October of 05, talking about fascism. And the sad, depressing, I'm trying to find a silver lining in this, about Donald Trump becoming elected, is that all those conversations we had about fascism back in the aughts, they've come back around, like a wide tie.
So basically, they've sort of, oh man, I hope that doesn't come back. But basically, Donald Trump has helped the archives.
That's right.
He's sort of given new life into
them. A renewed sense of purpose in the deep archives.
Lewis Lapham, though, was completely indispensable in that time, right? I mean, his columns were I remember reading them like, you know, I was even before college in Harper's. They were unbelievable.
I feel like we are at a big loss without people like Lewis Lapham.
Yes.
I mean, he's still alive, but he's not.
Is he still Lapham Quarterly? He had his
perhaps.
Own thing, yeah.
But he's not as public of an intellectual anymore. And it's tough because, you know, he was from a generation that saw a lot of like horrible crap. And we don't really have that amongst us anymore, right? I mean,
not the same historical awareness, no.
No, and so this is—it's good to have these voices. So enjoy this show. We will have another one for you tomorrow, and working our way up to New Year's, ladies and gentlemen, which is not going to be necessarily. Oh yeah, I guess our sort of like New Year's Eve show is a little bit more upbeat. That's the one with the libertarian. All right, we're going to take, enjoy this, folks.
Ha-ha.
See you tomorrow.
Well, I was feeling sad and kind of blue. I didn't know what I was going to do. The communists were coming around. They were in the air. They were on the ground. They were all over.
So I ran down most hurriedly and joined the jungle. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program best-selling author of the best-selling Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, Jane Mayer. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be with you.
Now, you know, this audience, and part of it is also a function of what you've written in the past in the New York. I think it was in 2010 you had that big piece on the Koch brothers. This audience, I think, is relatively familiar with the Koch brothers, and certainly I've spent, the past 5 or 6 years in the context of radio talking about the Koch brothers, but there was still a tremendous amount that I learned about them in your book. And on top of that, I think what's more important is you're talking about the broader network and the implications of what they're doing, which I think is so important.
Well, to me, it was always eye-opening. I kept reporting that first story was kind of the tip of the iceberg, though it seemed like the whole thing at the time, but there was just always more and more and more. It's quite an amazing machine that this small group of billionaires has built. I think it's what to me is different, really, is there've always been rich Republicans and rich Democrats and kind of conventional money politics, but you've got sort of almost a third party here that is serving the interests of these people who some describe as oligarchs. I mean, they are really out for themselves and using all the tools of modern politics to push their interests in a way we haven't seen before. And it's almost like a third party.
I mean, I want to go back and start a little bit at the Powell memo, because that's also something that I think, you know, we've talked about on this program, but there was a part of that story which I had never heard before as well. But just broadly speaking, I mean, when we talk about wealthy people influencing our politics, I mean, of course, you know, you go back to the robber baron age, and certainly at the turn of the 18th into the 19th century, you know, so much was sort of dictated by a wealthy landowner, let's say. But what makes this unprecedented? Is it the coordination? Is it the amount of money? Is it the sort of almost like they're almost an institution now beyond just sort of these individuals?
Well, in the past, for instance, in the robber baron era, you had big businesses who would give their money to a fixer like Mark Hanna, who would then give it to candidates. Okay, so it's a kind of a more conventional role of big money. What you have now is something that's operationalized the money. So you've really got, as I said, it's like a third party. You have got more people working for the Koch network as paid employees than work for the Republican National Committee. Three times more, not just a few more. You've also got a bigger budget for the Koch network than the Republican National Committee, twice as much as was spent in 2012, is what this small group, and it's only 400 or 500 people at most, is planning to spend in the 2016 election cycle. As we've all seen, it's approaching $900 million. And so you've got, it's not just the money, it's what's been built with this money, is there are paid state directors in almost every state. There are think tanks literally in every state that are allied with them. There are national think tanks that are also allied with them, all of which are pumping out position papers. And then you've got a kind of a professional political machine that is gathering its own big data, mobilizing voters, sending out volunteers and paid people door to door to knock on doors and make people, you know, follow in their footsteps and get to the polls. It's a full-fledged political machine, and it's, don't just take my word for it that it's unrivaled and new. The Kochs, behind closed doors, when they're talking to their own donors, describe it as unrivaled. They have described it, and I've got a tape of them talking that's in the final chapter of this book, where they're talking to their own donors recently, and they say, this is an integrated pipeline and an integrated network that the other side doesn't have anything like. And they're right. I mean, they've built something. The Kochs started as engineers. They both graduated from MIT. They looked at the political system as a system that you could sort of figure out how to apply pressure to, and they built the new machine.
And it's not just, and I want to circle back to that, but it also seems to me to have been a cultural project too, that it's not just about electoral
right.
results.
True. Yes, you're so right about that, and I'm so glad you picked up on that, because people think, oh well, they didn't win in 2012 when they backed Mitt Romney, so they really aren't so powerful. But it is so much more than just about elections. And this is the thing that I tried to tell in this book, was to go back and say, hey, look, this is a 40-year project they've been working on with a few other extraordinarily wealthy extreme conservatives who've poured family fortunes into trying to really change the cultural and political conversation in America you mentioned the Powell memo. And I'm sure, because you've got a smart listenership, people are aware that Lewis Powell wrote this memo in 1971 that was kind of a blueprint for how there could be a counter-establishment built that would push back against liberalism in America, and just kind of against the consensus and the general feeling that government does good in America, which prevailed in 1971. And so what I learned when I was researching this that was new, and I hadn't known it, was that Powell was a member of this tiny little secretive club, kind of, that was led by Richard Mellenscaife, the heir to the Gulf oil fortune, had many billions of dollars, and he was a very conservative fellow, and he had this little group called the Club to Save Carthage.
Yes.
And Powell was part of it, and they sat around thinking, how can we, as they looked at it, save America from being sacked by liberals? We'll take it back. And they plotted and they planned, and Scaife poured in, by his own reckoning, about $1 billion into this project over the ensuing years. And how do I know this? I got a copy of his unpublished memoir, and I have a chapter that draws on his own thinking and writing about this, in which he describes these early planning sessions. And it's really eye-opening. It's wonderful history. I was a history major at Yale, and I have been covering politics in Washington since Reagan arrived in town, and I covered the White House for the Wall Street Journal. It really fills in a lot of the story about, oh my God, so this is how we got here.
Well, it's also, you know, it's really sort of terrifying in many respects. It's also really there's a quality of all of this that I think, and I want to ask you, because I know that you've been in reporting circles for many years, and also dealing with many of the figures who you now sort of revisit and perceive, I guess, I mean, you tell me if this is a fair assessment, you now have sort of reassessed who they are, because you see them in the context of more of a system, as opposed to just more sort of being these sort of freelance players who are sort of bumping around in the universe, that they're all sort of like in some ways filling a purpose in a greater plan. I mean,
and it sounds so paranoid or sort of conspiracy minded or whatever. You know, it sounds like Hillary Clinton talking about the vast right wing conspiracy, though it's funny. There's a quote in this book from Karl Rove, the Republican political operative, saying, hey, people call us the vast right wing conspiracy, but we've really been a half assed right wing conspiracy. Now's the time to get to work. He's talking about after Citizens United, and that's what you see. And really, after 2010, they actually started a whole new level of money in this machine. But yeah, I mean, you can see, I mean, people I used to interview when I was at the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Bureau, sort of because, I mean, I was always interested in their ideas, people like Paul Weyrich, who really defined the far-out right fringe, and nobody would talk to them. They were kind of social pariahs in Washington. But what interested me was, how did they get from that position in 1984 when I was first covering them to this place where they are the center of gravity in the Republican Party? The radicals have taken over the party, and they are pulling the whole thing far to the right. And, you know, so they, and if you peel back the layers, what you can see is there's been an endless amount of persistent planning and funding going into all of this, and they've been very strategic and smart. And they've kept at it through, so they win some elections, they lose some elections. The money just keeps coming.
Right. I mean, this is all a function of percentages, right? I mean, they're not going to win and be successful. And it seems to me that part of their strategy is almost like a has been, and particularly since I think 2010, but even before that on some level, has been like a sort of like a big VC fund, where we're going to plant all of these seeds, and we anticipate that, you know, 30%, 40% are going to fail, but the or even 60%, but the other ones that take root are going to grow into institutions. And so you have, like, you know, the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and Hillsdale College, and I'm sure we go on and on and on about these sort of these things that have taken root and are beginning to impact the culture. I mean, that was the part about the Powell memo that also I wasn't fully aware of, that he saw as the enemy the sort of like the
intelligentsia.
Yes.
That to me was so interesting also, because he's writing in 1971 when, you know, most conservatives were railing about, oh, those hippies, the anti-war movement and the kids in the streets, and, you know, those are what they saw as the enemy. And Powell says, who at the time was a lawyer for on the board of the tobacco companies, among other things, so he's really connected into very big corporate power in America, and he says, those are not the enemy. The people who are the real enemy are the professors in colleges, they are the preachers in the pulpits, they are the scientists, they are the opinion makers on the editorial pages of the newspapers, and they are the judges on the benches across America. These are the people who we have to take on, and we need to grow our own and replace, first oppose them and then replace them. And so you can look at, this is 1971, take a look at what they've built since then. You know, a tremendous legal movement with the Federalist Society, which was funded by these private foundations that were filled up with money by these families, and the huge push on academia, which the Kochs are especially leading right now. They've got programs in between 220 and 300 colleges and universities that are pushing their point of view, and many other areas as well. And science, of course, you know, take a look at the whole sort of phony science that's pushed back against the reality of global warming. It's really been beautifully thought through. It's not completely successful, but it's influencing America in many ways on many levels.
I want to talk about that. I want to get to that success sort of quotient and whether or not the rate of success is increasing, whether it's been a function, because for an extended period of time, I think of when the Koch brothers have been expending this money and making these plans, I don't think there's been an awareness of sort of the scope of it, and an awareness both in terms of from their political foes and, frankly, from the media that has covered it, because, you know, I think things have not been attributed to them that maybe should have. But let me ask you this question. Many times, right, there's, you know, and I've been on MSNBC debating people who are, they don't perceive themselves as part of the Koch machine, but they work for places and they identify as libertarians, and they really get upset when you say stuff like this about the Koch brothers. I mean, they really get upset about it. And they say, look, the Koch brothers are anti-corporate cronyism. How do you, I mean, work that out for us? Because on one hand, right, they're against ethanol subsidies, but it seems to me that the Koch brothers get government subsidies in two ways. One, they their externalities are put upon all of us and the government. So they'll poison the rivers. They'll do, and I think you write that they have been like the only company. And they're the second biggest company in the world, or I should say in the country, private owned, that I've learned from you as well, that They're the only company that has been in the top five for air, water, and climate pollution. And that's all, right? We're all subsidizing that in some fashion. But we also give them direct subsidies. How do they square that? How do they reconcile that?
Well, there's a lot of hypocrisy in it, face it. And when they're talking about corporate cronyism now, I mean, I think I really think the press and the public needs to take a pretty close look at what they're really talking about. What they're most upset about when they're talking about corporate cronyism is the government trying to provide subsidies of some sort or tax breaks of some sort to alternative energy. They don't want to see wind or any kind of renewable fuel, solar, whatever, get in the way of their fossil fuel business. And that is the main thing that's really been setting them off about this. The fossil fuel business, though, meanwhile, has been gigantically subsidized over the years, including their own business. And what their argument is about why they take advantage of all the tax breaks and subsidies available to the oil, gas, and coal industry, all of which they're in, is they say, well, we'd be foolish not to take advantage of it because it would be hard on our bottom line. Well, whatever. The point is they are highly subsidized and they are posing similar kinds of helping hands for alternatives that might compete with the polluting sorts of energy that they produce. And they're not paying for the pollution that they create in terms of the climate. It is, as you say, a gigantic externality. And if they did, it would cut hugely into their profits. And they are tremendously profitable. I mean, these two brothers are now, there's a new list out just as of last week. I think that now says they're both worth about $45 billion each. These are two individuals. Together, $90 billion. And they've got this, as you said, the second largest private company in America. It does $115 billion a year of business. But still, they just fight for every penny for this bottom line they've got.
And I mean, so are they... So when you think about, I mean, is it the wrong question to ask if they are if they're sincere? I mean, in other words, like they're true believers, but yet I guess maybe everybody does this in their lives.
I think most, the surprise to me covering Washington for all these years is most people who you think of as maybe doing something kind of shady, they tend not to admit it or even think it. They usually rationalize it for the most part. They find and in this case, both these brothers will claim that what's good for their own fortunes and what's good for their company is what's good for America. So they've kind of constructed an ideology that's around self-interest. And so it's impossible to separate one from the other, having spent a lot of time looking at it. I will say, though, you do occasionally come across examples of them compromising their pure libertarianism in order to boost their own wealth. And one example of that is in the very beginning of the book, where people may remember that the bailout of the banks, the TARP program, was something that supposedly set off conservatives against Obama. And it was supposed to be something that many people thought turned the Kochs against Obama. And, of course, it was Bush's idea, too. But that's not so. What I found in doing deeper reporting was Koch Industries switched its position on TARP. Originally, it was against it, the way libertarians would be ordinarily. But when the stock market fell apart, it dropped something like 500 points that day. Koch Industries' political arm, Americans for Prosperity, switched sides and said, bail out the banks. They were looking like everybody else who had money, and many people who didn't, looking at a bottomless pit of financial disaster. And at that point, they flinched, and they didn't stick with pure libertarianism. They said, get that government involved and bail out those banks.
Well, I mean, I guess the theory being that, right, if they don't have money, they were not going to be able to save America.
Well, who knows? But whatever it is, it's not a pure libertarian position, and it's a point where they switched positions when their own self-interest was at stake. And, I mean, I don't think they're unlike many other people in that, but then they shouldn't really cast themselves as just doing this only for altruistic and principled reasons. I think most Americans realize that there are not a lot of people who put the kind of money these brothers are putting into politics with their friends. $900 million in the 2016 election cycle. Not that many people, I think, look at that and say, oh, I'm sure it's just altruistic.
Right. Well, let me ask you this about that network, because you've got basically 400 or so millionaires, right? And I don't know if we know how much.
And billionaires.
And billionaires.
I was counting the billionaires, too, trying to figure it out. In the first term, I think I counted 17 or 18 or 19 billionaires that were arranged in this little group against Obama. A lot of money.
So, and together, at least in terms of what they've publicly stated, and this, I don't know if this includes like what they offer in terms of all this institutional support. I guess it probably doesn't in terms of like colleges and whatnot. But, you know, anywhere from 750 million to 899 million. And so you set up this network. Now, when they set up this network, because I'm just trying to calculate, like, what if, I mean, $1 billion, right? I mean, that's an entire campaign. You know, that's basically what
either of the parties spend on the whole thing. Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that is like 1/45th of my assets. Which would be, I don't know, a couple thousand dollars or whatever it is. But I'm just saying, like, they could just...
Proportionally, it's not that big a deal to them, is what you're saying, right?
Right, they could just spend that.
It's a small investment for them.
But what's the idea?
And it pays off.
What's the idea, though, with the network? I mean, so are they trying to make sure that they don't have any rivals? Is that why they bring these people in? Is it just sheer...
No, it's a brilliant plan. I mean, it's a magic trick. What they do, I mean, first of all, one of the things that I learned in researching the Kochs is people, they are obviously enormously rich, but they're also quite cheap if they can get away with it. And what this does is... It brings in all the other rich people that are allied with them, and those guys then contribute much of the money for a kitty, which the Kochs then control. They're quite. It's a really ingenious plan, actually. So they've got this war chest that they and their operatives pretty much oversee the dispersal of, but it doesn't even have to be all their money. So they're good business people, clearly.
Now, I don't want to oversell the electoral side of this, because it seems to me what I find really fascinating about your book is just sort of really for people to have the opportunity to understand how deeply sort of ingrained in our society their influence is. And you know, that's a much more sort of like, I guess, glacial change as opposed to sort of, you know, who's going to win the presidency this year. But give me a sense of like when we watch, okay, Bush's money did obviously, I think it's fairly safe to say now, didn't work in the context of the Republican primary. What does that tell us about the strength of money in these elections? And B, what are they doing? I just saw a piece the other day saying that they're going to get heavily invested in fighting Trump if he comes out of New Hampshire very strong. Do they have rivals within like sort of Republican circles? In other words, where are they? Are they in Cruz's camp? Are they fighting the establishment camp and Cruz's camp and Trump's camp? I mean, where are they, you know, who are they aligned with, or do they own all of what we consider alt-Republicanism now?
I'd say every major Republican candidate for the presidency other than Trump has kissed their ring. They've all trooped to the Kochs' so-called seminars, where they meet with their donors twice a year in secret and begged for financial backing from this group. And they could go with any of them, I think, that would be faithful to their positions, and most of them so far have said they would be. The problem with Trump is he's uncontrollable.
Right.
And so, you know, he doesn't necessarily share their vision, but the rest of them are willing to sort of trudge along and pay homage to their positions on everything from global warming. The rest of the candidates and Trump too have said, you know, they don't believe the science and they don't think it's a serious problem. But more importantly, what really the glue holding this group together is keeping taxes low for the ultra rich and keeping regulations off of businesses. Those are the two issues that matter most to these. They call themselves investors, these 400 or so people. And that's what they're investing in. They want to make sure that those policies continue. And part of the way they keep their taxes, that they want to keep the taxes low, is by cutting government services, particularly things like Social Security, which they would like to privatize. And that's another area of disagreement they have with Trump. Trump has said that he thinks Social Security should be strengthened. But this group, they want to slash government spending, which means slashing spending for social programs, and that brings down their taxes. And so that's what they're and pretty much, I mean, what I was trying to write about was how a small group of people with extraordinary wealth have really put their imprint on a lot of Americans' lives. So you see they've really pulled the Republican Party far to the right from where it was even during Reagan's era when I was covering the first White House that I covered. It just and they have taken it way far to the right from say where Richard Nixon was when he believed in welfare policies and he also helped set up the EPA. These people want to abolish the EPA. The environmentalism used to be a bipartisan issue that both parties supported. In the hands of these funders, it's become, you know, one of the piñatas that they bash.
And we should say that they work both ends of this, right? I mean, when those candidates come out and deny climate science, it's because the electorate, I mean...
I took a pretty close look at public opinion on this. That what you can see, and you can follow the money. The money first. The money in the form of campaign contributions is what led many Republican candidates to deny global warming. And the candidates were far to the right of the public on this issue. But eventually, they then sort of lead the public on the thing, too, because then they start opposing global warming. I mean, they start denying the science and saying, if we do anything about global warming, it's going to raise your taxes. Then the public gets all, you know, up in arms about not wanting to have its taxes raised. But it starts really with the big money donors. If you look at the polls and look at what's been written, there's some good studies that were done by a government professor, Theda Skocpol,
right,
at Harvard about this. And the money moves way ahead of everybody else on this issue, and then the candidates follow the money, and then the public follows the candidates.
That's fascinating. Because to see that it actually is sort of top down on changing something so basic, I guess. I mean,
so important. I mean, and the question is, you know, I interviewed Michael Mann, who's a well-known climatologist on this, whose life became a living hell.
Yes.
Because these front groups funded anonymously by fossil fuel companies and people like the Kochs. These groups just came after him and tried to ruin his life, really. But the question he asks is, why is the U.S. Congress going in the opposite direction from the entire rest of the world on the issue of the reality of global warming? And why is science going in the opposite direction from the U.S. Congress? Everybody else in the world who's educated, and including almost all of science, is going in the opposite direction. So what's making the U.S. Congress an outlier? And his answer, if you can read this chapter, is money. It's very targeted, intense amounts of campaign contributions from fossil fuel players, some of them just straight to the candidates, and lots more that are very sneakily put into the system and just sort of demonize anybody who disagrees with them.
And we should say that, you know, Michael Mann, I think, outlined his problems with these paid, I guess, attempts to sabotage his career. I think it was in the hockey stick. I mean, I can't remember.
Right.
Hockey stick in the climate wars. We spoke to him about that. But you also, you were subject I think it was following your 2010. Was it following your 2010 piece, or was it sort of, did they get a sense of like, oh, she's writing a book about us. It's time to...
No, it was right. It was even before the 2010 piece came out. As I was working for the New Yorker, where I'm a staff writer, just researching, I've been covering politics forever. A big piece about who are the Koch brothers? What's their role in politics? I had noticed that they were pouring money into sort of training Tea Party uprisings and things. They started to fund a handful of Koch operatives, very senior people who've worked for the Kochs for a long time, started working with a private eye who was turned out to be the former police commissioner in New York to dig up dirt on me so that they could try to discredit my story when it came out. And they kept working even after it came out to try to see if they could stop anyone from believing what I'd written. They sort of tried to plant negative stories about me in the press. Luckily, I caught them, along with a couple other good reporters. Nobody would buy take the bait from them because what they were peddling wasn't true. But it was a really eye-opening demonstration to me of how rough they play. And I discovered as I was working on the book, I'm far from alone. They've used private eyes to go after all kinds of people who've challenged Koch Industries or themselves. And they've used private eyes on their own brothers when they've been in legal wars
right.
with them and against even federal prosecutors.
And so let me ask you, you work in this world of political reporters. I mean, how has been... the revelations from your book, I mean, how have they been received by other sort of like, I guess, of mainstream reporters, if you will? I mean, this is like a big part of the story that we never hear on the news for the most part. Maybe, and I come from sort of the more, I think, overtly partisan opinion side of the news. But in, we're not going to hear, I don't know, the guy they've got anchoring ABC News to say, climate skepticism. And of course, this is all because somebody spent $400 million on sort of developing this opinion. I mean, is there a broader understanding that, we spend so much time of like data journalists and all these explanations? Is there yet this huge part of the story, maybe the story, seems to be left out as in the day-to-day reporting of these things? Do you see that changing at all?
The problem is, and the reason it's a book and not just a story, is connecting the dots is really hard in the internet age because everything comes at you so fast. There's just these little fragments of information. And so it's hard for, blogs and places like that to really tell the big story. The big story is there are actual characters, live people in America who are supersized personalities with humongous fortunes who are engaged in a big project here. And it's hard to put it all together. It took me years. So I don't really fault the press maybe as much. I think I have some incredibly talented peers whose work I drew on a lot in this book, including the New York Times, which has done some great reporting about money in politics. I mean, they did something recently that was about how, that most of the money in politics right now in the campaign is coming from something like 250 individuals. And, and Politico, they've got some great reporting on it. That's a political website. It's hard to do because most of this money is secret, and that's why the book's called Dark Money. This is money that you have to bang your head against the wall to follow, and even when you do, you're not going to get all of it. So it's secretive. It's like a secret project.
And lastly, I mean, in the course of sort of documenting all this, do you see a weakness? In other words, like how, and it almost feels like they're just ramping up. Like, 2010, the gloves came off and their personal wealth has tripled. And, presumably as wealth inequality increases, that, you know, that that group of 400 could easily be 500 next year. I mean, is there a structural flaw? Is there a
I think that's the worry is that there's going to be kind of an exponential growth of power that goes along with this concentration of money, so that the that our democracy gets tipped in some way into the hands of people, just the tiny few, not working for everybody, and that's the worry. But I actually think there are a few good, you know, positive signs this year. Hope springs eternal. One of them is that I think the public is quite disgusted with this idea that money is just distorting politics to such an extent. So you see Bernie Sanders raising money in a completely different way, huge numbers of small donors. And even, I don't necessarily think this is a healthy sign, but Donald Trump's a different model. He's one super rich billionaire running himself, and when you hear people say why they liked him, it was because they didn't see him as bought by anybody else. I think the public doesn't like the idea of candidates who seem so bought and paid for. And that's a healthy sign. And if they do something about it, then that'll be even healthier.
Jane Mayer, the book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Thank you so much. We will, of course, link to that book at majority.fm, a really important and just an amazing effort and great work. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
All right, but Donald Trump, and I want to make this clear, and I made this clear, I think, on like the second day after he announced himself, is not the only buffoon and utterly, I mean, just in many different ways, despicable candidates running in the Republican race. John Kasich. John Kasich has come off as a slightly curmudgeon-y but reasonable guy over the course of the campaign to a lot of people. That's because they didn't bother to actually look at the policies he's put in place. But here, John Kasich gives an amazing lesson on the dynamic of things like mansplaining, blacksplaining, things like white privilege. Think about how arrogant you have to be to enter into a yeshiva, which is a Jewish Orthodox school, essentially. In this case, it was with Hasidic Jews. Jews who dress in garb from the 1700s, I believe, the 1800s, and maintain an extremely orthodox, fundamentalist form of Judaism. And not ask your aides, what's the situation here? What am I going into? And now, I want you to contemplate this. You are an aide to a governor who is running for the presidency. You have obviously set this situation up, right? Like, you don't just accidentally walk into a yeshiva. You obviously have set this up for John Kasich. And you say to the governor, Governor, let me just brief you on what the situation is. And what is it that the governor said to not get that information? Was it something like, hey, I worked at Lehman Brothers. I understand how to talk to Jews. Okay. It was clearly something that revealed his enormous arrogance, because the clip you're about to see, John Kasich is explaining one of the most rudimentary stories of the Bible to people, to men specifically, who do nothing but study the Bible or the Torah 8 to 10 hours a day for their entire life. They don't do anything else. They make their wives cook, clean, and make the money. They stay at school or at home and study the Talmud. To like, they don't just study the Bible. They study the commentary of the commentary of the commentary of the commentary of the Bible. This you can find probably on Wikipedia. But John Kasich, he doesn't need to hear any. I got this. I can tell you that my 10-year-old daughter, who has only one Jewish parent, who is determined to learn nothing at Hebrew school, knows the story that John Kasich is explaining to these guys. If you have seen the Broadway production, Joseph and the Technicolor Coat, you know this story. Okay? This is the equivalent of John Kasich walking in to, I don't know, the physics department at Columbia University and going like, have you guys ever heard of Albert Einstein? Here is John Kasich surrounded by Hasidic yeshiva students.
Talking about start
he's going to give you a lecture.
What are you get out of here. The story of the people are Abraham, when God made a covenant with Abraham, not Moses.
Yeah, but you know what? In our prayers, yes, we do mention Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah, like they were important.
But it's when we refer to the laws, we refer to the laws of Moses and Israel.
Okay.
So Moses is up there. Moses is up there.
Yeah, I believe it. So is Isaac and.
Well, let's see if we can find a book that would.
Pause it. Now. The visual here is like everybody's just trying to be polite. Like, Jews know who Abraham is. Particularly Jews who are really, really Jewy.
Mr. Casey, nice to meet you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you for coming to Baruch.
How are you? What do you guys do?
Students.
Where do you study? Where do you study?
Overseas.
Where?
Israel.
And what are you studying?
Talmud.
Okay, but what are you learning right now?
Well,
what is your lesson?
Shabbat. Most of the Shabbat and stuff.
The laws of the Sabbath.
Yes. You know who I like?
Who?
Joseph. You guys like Joseph? You studied Joseph?
Who is this?
What'd you think about Joseph? Did you hear what the most important thing Joseph said to his brothers? You, my brothers, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Did you know that?
Yes.
Well, what am I going to have to go over?
Yeah, we do.
They're awestruck.
No, do you know this? Yes.
Pause it. What they're doing right now is they're saying, yeah. And in their head, they're going, because we're not 2.5 years old.
Because his brothers, they hated him, you know, because part of it, he may have been a little bit of a braggart, you know, Joseph. May have been a little bit, maybe. But they threw him in that ditch and his brothers saved him and then they sold him into slavery. And that's how the Jews got to Egypt.
Oh,
right? Did we know that?
Oh.
Yes. Good.
Pause it. Thank you for telling us. You know, Passover's coming up and that would be a very interesting thing to bring up at Passover. Thank you. We're going to be able, I can't wait to tell the rabbi. Did you know, Rabbi, that the way we keep talking about the Jews leaving, but we never talk about the way they got there. But thank God, Hashem sent us John Kasich to explain.
Yeah, and then he was telling his brothers, you know, like, you're going to worship me, you know, and they're like, what? Right? So he really didn't like them. But
he didn't want to say that.
You think Jacob knew that?
It says that Jacob really knew.
Is that in the scripture?
But he didn't want to develop further jealousy. So he says, what do you, my wife and I, we're going to bow down to you. And he really knew that it was.
It's a great story. It's one of my favorites. Because I can't figure out what Joseph ever did wrong. You know, most of the people in all the Bible, whether it's the new or the old, all have flaws. I'll tell you another guy.
Pause it. Now, Jews don't perceive their Bible as the old Bible. That's just a quick tip. I mean, if you're on a Dale Carnegie class and you're trying to sell things to your Jewish merchants, don't say that their Bible's the old one.
I can see that. Have you ever heard of Dale Carnegie? You ever read him, Governor? Yeah. This is not a good...
Somewhere around there, the advisor's going like, John, maybe it's time for us to go and... I got this. Believe me, I got this.
Any flaws that I don't think I can see. Joshua was another great leader. You know about Joshua?
He was the disciple of Moses.
Yes, he was. I know he was. I know that. I'm going to have to teach him. Yeah. We're going to have to ride around all day. Newman will teach him.
That is just one of the most obnoxious, arrogant. I mean, so stunning. I mean, this guy walked into that situation, was so, so confident of himself without an iota of debriefing. I got this. I worked at Lehman Brothers. I know how to deal with these people.
What they like is when you tell them about scriptures that they've probably never heard of because they're in their Jew zone.
I'm picking up the sense that these guys are maybe religious. So I got this. Yeah.
They take their religion seriously. Let me educate them on it. They'll appreciate it.
I want to be able to show that I can teach people.
The one part that I did like, though, just because, I mean, no hate to Hasids. I love them. But on some level, when you ask a Hasid male what they do, it's always a little funny.
Well.
Like, literally, what do you do? And then they're like, we spend all day, as you say, studying the book that you're about to give a lecture on.
Yeah. They said we study the Talmud. He goes, I know that. But I mean, what specifically? Like plumbing or...
You study the plumbing. Is that bagel making? No, I'm just kidding.
Unbelievable. Well, I mean, that was...
You're going to have to shave down that beard if you want to be my accountant. All right. Let me tell you about Abraham.
That
you guys know about him?
Honestly, that captures John Kasich, I think, so well. So unbelievably well. Because this is how John Kasich, he has this same pedantic, arrogant quality when he deals with anybody who's not him. And that means cut off funding for Planned Parenthood, tell women how to work their uterus, essentially. Tell people living in poverty and struggling with getting enough food, I can take care. I know exactly how much food stamps you need for me to roll back.
Or imagine as president, he's like, welcome to China for your state.
I got the
Great Wall.
Are you aware there's a Great Wall?
Yeah, well, you didn't just invent the General Chow's
chicken. Here's something you're going to really appreciate. I eat spaghetti. Do you know where that came from?
A lot of people think it's from Italy.
This is like Rand Paul, right? When he went to the NAACP. Was it Howard,
I believe. Howard University.
Or Howard University. Right. And he said, are you aware that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican?
Listen up, young Negroes. Did you know that Republicans used to like you? And now I sort of do too, in a sense.
Really?
I know you don't learn that in your NWA day records, but look, as long as you're not by my swimming pool, I don't think cops should tase you. Can I count on your support?